Ecclesiastes. This morning we looked at the man behind the book, Solomon. We looked at his motto, vanity of vanities, emptiness, emptiness. We looked at his motive, that we may have hope. We looked at the main feature, or the key to the book, that little phrase, under the sun, as he looks at life from two alternating positions. Ecclesiastes. It's a book that asks some hard questions of ourselves about our life, about this life in general. And Solomon the preacher has explained to us that life lived under the sun. That is, life lived apart from God. Life lived without reference to God is empty, and it's vain, and it's meaningless, and it's without substance and real satisfaction. Now, that's a very, very hard thing to say, but it's a very realistic thing that Solomon says. But now he wants to back it up. And he begins to shut off the possible attempts by various people who may object to his claim. So you may have been sitting this morning listening to Solomon's claims and thinking to yourself, well, I would disagree with that. Because there are people who would say, you know, I don't need to resort to God or to have a relationship with God in order to find any meaning in life. I can find meaning in life in X, Y, Z, whatever. And what Solomon is going to do over the next several chapters is cut off every possible objection to the claim that life without God is meaningless. Listen to these several statements taken from the first chapter of an evangelistic book. Jim worked hard all his life. He had just retired, and we were looking forward to enjoying ourselves. Now he's dead. What's the point of it all? We brought this child into the world, did our best for him. Now he's rebellious, goes his own way, never says thank you, and now he's in trouble with the police. What's the point of it all? I've been married for several years. I thought everything was going fine. And now my husband has run off with someone else. What's the point of it all? I've worked hard at school, went to university, got my qualifications, and now I can't get a job. What's the point of it all? It took us 8 years before we could have a child. And now my little girl has cancer. What's the point of it all? The way things aren't going to get any better. They're all going to get much worse. What's the point of it all? I go to work, I come home, I eat, I sleep. I go to work, I come home. I eat, I sleep. Life is one dreary bore. What is the purpose of life? Why am I here? Is there a God? Does he care? You know, such questions are not new. And these questions that are raised here are the questions that Solomon seeks to answer in the book of Ecclesiastes. Thomas Edison conducted 50,000 experiments, all of which failed before inventing a new storage battery. When someone commented on his lack of results, he replied, "Results? I've got plenty of results. I know 50,000 things that don't work." Well, Solomon will tell you a few things that won't work. And it will save you a lot of trouble if you will listen to him. That's what he wants to do here in these opening chapters. He wants to speak from his own experience of life and tell us where we will not find the answer to those questions. What we have here is a series of experiments into the meaning and purpose of life. What's it all about? Now, before we look at those experiments and consider Solomon's conclusion, just let us remind ourselves of his approach, his scientific method. As I said this morning, every scientist conducting experiments wants to do so under the most favorable of conditions. So you take a man like Solomon. You put yourself in Solomon's shoes. You've got a brain. You've got a wise head on your shoulders. You have plenty of money, unlimited resources, plenty of servants to send all over the world to do your research. So you've got unlimited time at your disposal. Imagine you've got all of those things. Now let's look at life through the eyes of a man like that. What has life got to offer someone like that? If anyone can discover the meaning and the purpose of life, surely it's this man, Solomon. You know, he lived life to a degree that none of us have come close. He tried every avenue of life that you could imagine, and many that you probably haven't even imagined it yet. He is speaking from his vast experiences of life. And so what we have here are a series of experiments that Solomon is conducting into the meaning of life. These are deliberate experiments, things that he has delved into in order to find the meaning of life. The first experiment that Solomon tries is at the end of chapter 1. And the first experiment is the philosophical approach. Verses 16 and 17. I commune with my heart, saying, look, I have attained greatness and have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge, and I set my heart to know wisdom. So you see, friends, he's going to try and think it out. And surely nobody is more qualified for thinking it out than Solomon. The wisdom of Solomon is proverbial. Even the man on the street has heard of the wisdom of Solomon. Solomon had a great breadth of understanding. You know, 1 Kings 4:29 records that God gives Solomon wisdom and exceedingly great understanding, like the sand of the seashore. So if anyone has the brain power to think his way into the meaning of life, it's King Solomon. And what does he say about it? Verse 18, much wisdom increases joy. Much wisdom increases contentment. Much wisdom increases opportunity. No, you see it there, for a much wisdom is much grief. And he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Now, what a strange thing to say. But it's true, isn't it? The past 50 years have seen an explosion of human knowledge, the like of which no previous generation has witnessed. There are people, maybe not in this congregation, but certainly in the congregation back at APC, maybe some of us in this congregation can remember the time of the horse and cart. Is there anybody can remember the horse and cart? I can remember as a little boy, the horse and cart coming round our streets. And there's Joe's old enough too. And Jared, not the only one. Yeah, and you know, the rag and bone man with a horse and cart. And we've gone from that time. There's people in the congregation, the APC, would remember, you know, that vividly from their childhood. And we've gone from that era of the horse and cart. Some people still remember the era of sail and steam, you know, right through to space travel. And for hundreds of years, people never knew anything else other than horse and cart and sail and steam. And now suddenly people can travel around the world faster than the speed of sound. This great explosion of knowledge. But friends, is the world a safer place to live in? Is it a better place to live in? Is it a happier place to live in than it was, say, 50 years ago? You could say, well, in some ways it is. Modern science can give you an iPhone. It can give you an iPod. Give you the internet. It can now give you a washing machine that you can pull a little drawer out while the machine's on and you can pop the stuff in that you forgot to put in when you started the wash. Modern science can give you a Hoover. You don't even have to Hoover around the house with it. You just program it to your settings in your house and off it goes itself. Modern science can give you light at the flick of a switch. But friends, modern science can't tell you how to mend a broken relationship. You see, with all the advances in science, you'd expect the world to be a heaven on earth. But you know as well as me, it's nothing of the sort. And what Solomon is saying here is true, isn't it? The more you know, the worse it becomes. Now let's not think that learning and knowledge is wrong. I don't want any of you kids going to your parents afterwards and saying, "You hear what Billy the preacher says? You know, forget about going to school." You know, we're not saying that knowledge and learning is wrong. The Bible encourages learning. But friends, Solomon's point is this. This is not where the answer lies. The answer doesn't lie in human wisdom and human knowledge. The more you know, the worse it gets. And more than that, look at the little comment at the end of verse 15. And what is lacking cannot be numbered. You know, the more you know, the more you realize how little you don't know. Now, this morning I said we'd look at Solomon's assessment of life and pick up some of the themes and the statements that he's made, try to marry it with contemporary popular culture and compare those statements and those words of Solomon and what we hear today. You know, does it tally? Is this just the ramblings of an ancient, you know, figure from 3,000 years ago who couldn't possibly know anything about, you know, our world in this high-tech 21st century? Well, friends, listen to the lyrics of this song from the 70s by Johnny Nash. He was the first non-Jamaican reggae singer to make it big. The song he sang was "There Are More Questions Than Answers." Listen to this. "I have asked the question time and time again. What is life? How do we live?" Exactly the same question that Solomon is asking in this book. Now, how does Mr. Nash answer the question in the song? How does he reply? "There are more questions than answers. And the more I find out, the less I know." Why, Solomon isn't that ancient after all, is he? The more I find out, the less I know. Life is like a giant jigsaw puzzle. Part of APC House Party are the jigsaw puzzles. And people like to gather around the table and do those jigsaw puzzles. And if you started that jigsaw puzzle and you got the end of it and there were 3 or 4 pieces missing, boy, you would be frustrated, wouldn't you? You wouldn't even have started the puzzle if you knew there were 3 or 4 pieces missing. But life's like that. It's like a giant jigsaw puzzle with 3 or 4 pieces missing, and it's frustrating. And you try to put this jigsaw of life together in your mind, and there are whole chunks missing, and even the bits that you do get hold of don't seem to fit either. It's a frustrating business trying to think your way into the meaning of life. But it's worse than that, because even the little you do know doesn't help. He says in verse 15, "What is crooked cannot be made straight." Samuel Taylor Coleridge, poet, literary critic, philosopher, friend of William Wordsworth. Coleridge was hooked on opium, and it ruined his life. It spoiled his life, and he wanted to be free from that addiction. So what did he do? He hired someone to live with him and watch every move that he made during the course of the day in order to help him kick the habit. That's wisdom, isn't it? But it didn't work. Why didn't it work? Because immediately on hiring that person to watch him, Coleridge then began to scheme and devise plans in order to deceive the man that he was paying to help him kick the habit. And sort of we smile at that. The good that I would do, I don't. The evil that I shouldn't do, that I practice. Oh, wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death? I thank God, Jesus Christ. What is crooked cannot be made straight. There is a perversity in human nature. There is a defect in our nature. We are crooked morally. We are crooked spiritually. And what is crooked cannot be made straight. Cannot be made straight by common sense, human wisdom, scientific know-how. Human philosophy cannot deal with the problem of life, the basic problem of life, which is the problem of a fallen, broken human nature. You know what you're doing is wrong, but you keep doing it anyway. Philosophy. Thinking it out doesn't work. Well, let's try something else. Let's try living it up. That's his next experiment. So he turns from philosophy to pleasure. And that's where many people are at today. Chapter 2, he says, I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with mirth. Therefore enjoy pleasure. But surely this also was vanity. I said of laughter, madness, and of mirth. What does it accomplish? I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine while guiding my heart with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their lives. Many people have given up trying to find an answer by thinking it out. And so, instead of trying to make sense of it, rather than try to understand it, they just say, we'll live it up. So let's enjoy ourselves. Let's make hay while the sun shines. And that's the mood of today's society, isn't it? Anything goes, just so long as I get pleasure from it. As long as it makes me feel good. As long as it makes me happy. That's where so many people are today. That's where so many people live their lives today. And this isn't just escapism. It's much more sinister than that. Someone has described it as a deliberate flouting of rationality in an attempt to get at some secret to which reason bars the way. That's why you get a lot of the, you know, the psychedelic music coming out of Pink Floyd and that in the 60s into the 70s. Trying to circumvent reason. And that's what Solomon is doing here in verse 3. But he's not drowning his sorrows. You understand that. This isn't escapism. Because he goes on to say in verse 3, while guiding my heart. This is a deliberate experiment. He is not trying to take his mind off things. That's not the point of it. He's not trying to, you know, blot out the problem and the questions of life. He is deliberately trying to find the answer. He's not running away. He's trying to find in pleasure the answer. And what's his conclusion? What does he find? He says, surely this also was vanity. Madness. What does it accomplish? What does it deliver? Not only is he disappointed, but he's deeply disturbed and disillusioned by what he finds. My friends, there are a lot of people who can't wait to leave home. They can't wait to spread their wings. Maybe some of you young people could be describing you. You just can't wait to find out what life's all about and to shake off what you think are the shackles of living in a Christian home. The constraints of living in a Christian home where your parents are saying to you, we're going to church on a Sunday, or we're reading the Bible before you leave for school. And you want to experiment with life, and you're longing for the moment when you'll be able to, you know, go to university or college, and you think, that's the time when I'll be free. Well, dear young person, let me urge you, encourage you, to listen to this man, Solomon, because it will save you a lot of trouble. It will save you a lot of heartache. It will save you a lot of pain, because he knows. He's saying to you, he's shouting at you from the pages of this book, look, I've been there, done that, got the T-shirt. He's been places where you'll never go. He has experimented with things that you'll never experiment with. You know, sex. He had 1,000 mistresses. Any type of sex he wanted, he could have had. And young people today are told that that's where it's at. You know, the only relevant moral factor is whether you use a condom or not. And the young folk are told sex is where it's at. You know, you go drinking, you can go clubbing, you can live it up. Solomon tried it all. And what does he say? He says it's not the answer. Pleasure gratifies, but it doesn't satisfy. And there is a world of difference between those two things. It's a difference between heaven and hell. Remember what Jesus said about hell, that place where there is darkness, where there is a fire that never goes out, where the worm never dies, where there is that unquenchable thirst. You know, friends, that's part of the awfulness of hell. There's a thirst in the human spirit that is never satisfied. That's what empty, shallow pleasure is like. It gratifies, but it leaves you wanting more. It's like when you're thirsty on a summer's day, you take a glass of Coke. It's not long before you want another glass of Coke. Why? Because the manufacturers have made it that way. It doesn't quench your thirst. You think it does at the time, but it leaves you wanting more. It leaves you even more thirsty. And the pleasures of life are like that, says Solomon. You don't quench your thirst. You don't satisfy the deep longing of the human spirit by running after the empty, baseless things of this world. They'll gratify, yes, but they will not satisfy. There is no satisfaction there. And Solomon tried it. And he shouts back at us, it doesn't work. And why doesn't it work? Well, to quote Augustine of Hippo, God formed us. God created us for Himself. And our hearts are restless until we find our rest in God. And God is saying to us through the tragic life of Solomon, beware. Beware of the world's joy. Beware of the world's pleasure, because behind that superficial veneer of enjoyment and living it up, you take a step back and you think of the consequences of the world's joys. That's what he's saying. Pleasure doesn't work. Well, if that doesn't work, if thinking it out doesn't work, well, let's try working at life. That's his next approach. So he takes us from the contemplative life to the sensuous life. And now he's taken us to the active life. And notice what he says at the end of verse 9. Also, my wisdom remained with me. So he's still conducting this deliberate experiment. He's tried one thing, he's tried another, and now he's trying a different approach. He is desperate to find some meaning and purpose and satisfaction in life. So he says, let's try a more serious approach. Let's try working at it. Let's try putting something into it. And the word he uses for work in this passage, it's a very broad term, doesn't just refer to, toil, labor, but can also be applied much more broadly to the greater quests that people embark upon, whether it's politics or social reform or something else. And you find lots of people involved in lots of things, and they're just so busy. And you look at some people sometimes, and you're tired just looking at them. You know, they just seem to have this boundless energy. No limit to what they can do. And they seem to have time for everything. They seem to be interested in everything. You just wonder, how on earth they manage it. How on earth they manage to fit everything in. Solomon was that type of person. Read again and afterwards, from verse 4 onwards. It will just make you tired reading it. You see, he was determined to get as much out of life as he could. And he throws himself into life, and he fills every moment of every hour of every day with all kinds of worthwhile projects. He puts all these irons into the fire, and he has any number of pots on the boil at any one time. And that's, again, where a lot of people are. We call it living in the fast lane. And today that's where a lot of people are, burning up the days like fuel on the motorway. And Solomon says, I've tried that too. And it's a waste of time. Verse 11 of chapter 2, then I looked on all the works that my hands had done and on the labor in which I had toiled. And indeed, all was vanity and grasping for the wind, or chasing the wind. There's nothing to get your hand on. Now you understand he's not knocking work. He's not working, he's not knocking hard work. Good work ethic is a wonderful thing. A good work ethic is a biblical thing. His frustration is not with the work. He enjoyed the work. His frustration is not that he's not getting enough return for his work. He's not griping about the results of his work. What he's saying is, if you're trying to find satisfaction and significance in the work, you'll not find it. He's saying that the fruit of his labor has not served to fulfill his deepest yearnings, longings, and desires of being a human being. And there's something else he finds out during the course of his experiment into the meaning and purpose of life. And he's coming very close to the core of the problem. In verses 12 through to 17, then I turned myself to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who succeeds the king? Only what he has already done. Then I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Yet I myself perceive that the same offense happens to them all. So I said in my heart, as it happened to the fool, it also happens to me. And why was I then more wise? Then I said in my heart, this also is vanity. There is no more remembrance of the wise than of the fool forever, since all that now is will be forgotten in the days to come. And how does a wise man die? As the fool. Therefore I hated life, because the work that was done under the sun was distressing to me, for all is vanity and grasping for the wind. What man is looking for in life is permanence. Life is so pointless otherwise. And that's what Solomon is saying here. The wise man and the fool both have to die. So what's the point of it all? You know, why burn the midnight oil to get good A-level results or get a good degree at university? Whether you're a wise man or a fool, you're going to die. That's what Solomon is saying. The wise man, the fool, the sensual man, the cultured man, the sophisticated man, the workaholic, the alcoholic, the connoisseur, the collector, and all the people that he's talking about here in this chapter, they all come to the same end. We all have to die and leave this life. Not only that, but everything that we do must come to an end. Everything that we have worked for, everything that we have tried to accomplish, everything that we have managed to accumulate, what's going to become of it? We're going to leave it all behind. It doesn't follow us into the next life. We've got to leave it behind, and then what's going to happen to it? Then I hated all my labor in which I had toiled under the sun, and who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Who knows whether the son that comes after me is going to be a wise man or a fool? Verses 18 and 19. Yet he will rule over all my labor in which I toiled, in which I have shown myself wise under the sun. This also is vanity. My friends, that's exactly what happened in Solomon's case, wasn't it? He left his kingdom to a fool. Isn't that right? In 1 Kings chapter 12, Rehoboam rejected advice and he ruins in a day what Solomon took a lifetime to build up. There's no guarantee of the continuation of your work in the next generation. Many pursue work in politics or social reform because they think they're going to do, you know, some good. They think they're going to make the world a better place. But would Benjamin Disraeli recognize the Tory party? Would William Gladstone recognize the Liberal party? Would Keir Hardie recognize the Labour Party? Were they alive today? Your successors can change everything. And the preacher is thinking about that. It can happen in churches. You know, a man can give the best of his years to building a congregation on the Word of God. And then somebody else comes in and the work is ruined. Happens in churches, happens in politics, happens in business, happens in families. People so often try to find a reason for living in their children or their grandchildren. You know, we're building for our children, they say. You know, they will benefit. Well, who's to say they'll benefit? That's what Solomon is saying here. He's saying, look, don't count on it. He's saying, don't kid yourself. And the point is this, he's bringing us to a conclusion. If this is all there is to life, just what we experience of it under the sun, if this is just all there is, this life, then what's the point of it? Surely there must be more to life than what we know of it under the sun. Surely there must be more of life than what Solomon found in these experiments with God left out of the equation. And so this brings us to his conclusion at the end of chapter 2, verses 24, 25. Nothing is better for a man than he should eat and drink, and that his soul should enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw was from the hand of God. For who can eat or who can have enjoyment more than I? What's he saying? He's been saying, if you leave God out of it, life is meaningless. But you bring God into the picture and life looks so much different. You know, up to this point, Solomon hasn't even mentioned God. Not once has he referred to God. He's not referencing God. He's saying, okay, leave God out of the picture. Let's see where it leads. But now, as he starts to conclude his arguments, he brings God into the picture again. Life looks so much rosier. A simple lifestyle. But there's nothing better than that if you've got God. Godliness with contentment is great gain. Nothing is better, he says in verse 24, because this was from the hand of God. That's the important thing. That's what you want to underline in this section. It's not something inherent to man to find meaning and satisfaction in life. Man doesn't have it in him to find meaning and purpose in life. It's from the hand of God. It's grace, friends, in other words. That's what we mean by the hand of God, grace. It's something given by God. Man doesn't have the answer. Man doesn't have it in himself to make anything of life. It has to be given by God. That's Solomon's conclusion. You know, before the days when you downloaded your music and you have everything on your iPhone or your iPod, don't you? You know, maybe 500, 600, some of you maybe up to 1,000 of your favorite albums. You know, some of us remember the day when it was vinyl, and vinyl's making a comeback. Okay, so you might have a final collection. You know, the black record with the grooves on it. But that piece of vinyl, it's absolutely useless unless you have a record player. You can't enjoy it. Can't even hear it without a record player. And there you have this bit of vinyl. And then locked in those grooves, there's music. Depending on your taste of music, you might think it's wonderful. Somebody else might think it's terrible. But you know, some of those finals have locked in yet some of the beautifulest of symphonies. And you see, friends, there is music they're in your life somewhere. But no one will hear it until you're brought into a relationship with the God who made you. Until you're connected to the God who made you. And when you're connected to the God who made you, then that beautiful music starts to come out. It starts to play. And some of you can sit there and say, you know, I've tried praying, I've tried Christianity, tried religion, tried God, but it doesn't seem to do anything. You know what the problem is? The problem isn't God. The problem, says the Bible, is that your sin has come between you and God. That's the problem. You can't sit there and say, you know, I've tried that, tried praying, tried this, tried that, tried the other, didn't work. Hold on, says the prophet Isaiah, God's ear is not heavy that it does not hear. The Bible says the problem is you. And that's what we don't like to hear. We don't like to hear that the problem's us, that it's our sin that comes between us and God. When the Bible tells us we're lost, we don't like to hear that. But that's what the Bible tells us. And when the Bible tells us we're lost, it doesn't mean we're lost in regards to our whereabouts. It means we're lost in respect to our relationship with God. And Jesus came to seek and to save the lost. That's why he came into the world. And so you're here at this house party. Maybe you're not a Christian. Maybe some of these things that Solomon has thrown up are things that you've been wrestling with. Maybe you're realizing, yes, it's my sin. It comes between me and my Creator God. And I'm lost. Well, Jesus Christ came to save you. He came to seek and to save that which was lost. Came to heal that broken relationship so that you may connect with your living Creator God, and that music that is locked in your life would come flowing out of it. And you would come to know those solid joys and lasting treasures that only Sion's children know. You know, the world knows nothing of the joys that the people of God know. The world can only give you a superficial joy, a hollow joy. Jesus Christ says that I have come to give you life and that you can have it abundantly. Solid joys, lasting treasure, none but Sion's children know. Summed up in our closing hymn, glorious things of thee are spoken, Sion, city of our God.